This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Craig Simons, Emeritus Professor of History from the U.S. Naval Academy. Nimitz at War, Command Leadership from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay, the relationships of the flag officers and the generals as they prosecute the Pacific War, which was secondary in the minds of the joint command, joint chiefs of staff, the British and American working together. Europe first, Europe first. Ernest King, however, had other ideas, and Ernest King has sent Chester Nimitz to Pearl Harbor to command this rotating story of ships and men and aircraft. Now, King says Coral Sea and Midway are such a success, we need to go on the offensive somewhere. They do not have adequate what is called sea lift. They do not have adequate what are called forces, divisions. However, they're going to get out there even though they're short, what Nimitz says repeatedly in the professor's book, do the best we can with what we've got. So we go to Tulagi, which we know is Guadalcanal, the Marines land, and the fleet that accompanies them, the ships that accompany them, cannot stay all the time. They have other duties and they don't want to be tied to a shore to make themselves vulnerable. These are very risky moments again, Professor. What was Nimitz's thinking of Guadalcanal? Did he want to wait or was he okay with the idea of going now, even though we have inadequate resources?
Nimitz did indeed plan on taking the offensive as soon after the Battle of Midway as possible. What he had in mind was an attack on the Santa Cruz Islands, which are a little bit to the southeast of Guadalcanal, and Tulagi. Tulagi is a tiny little island, but it's where the Japanese headquarters were. But across the Sealark Channel from Tulagi is this much larger island of Guadalcanal. And while Nimitz and King were in San Francisco having a conversation about whether or not they could undertake this small offensive, news arrived that the Japanese were building an airfield on Guadalcanal. Oh my gosh, King says, we've got to preempt that. We have to stop that. So that immediately the target is changed from the Santa Cruz Islands to this island of Guadalcanal. And as you mentioned, it's a bit of a risk to undertake this now in August of 1942, because the United States really doesn't yet have the material superiority to launch an amphibious operation. But King believes it's essential to go ahead now anyway. And so the Guadalcanal operation begins in the second week of August 1942 by a shoestring, just enough shipping to get the men ashore, maybe not enough shipping to keep them adequately supplied. And for the next 6 months, this is going to be a very precarious movement onto this jungle-infested island of Guadalcanal.
Life in Pearl Harbor at the same time for the admiral, because he's making these decisions and managing this enormous landscape of the Pacific Ocean. And they are also conducting their lives while they're waiting or while officers are coming in. The admiral likes a small staff, but it will grow to hundreds in the course of the war. He also likes exercise, especially walking a great deal. Who are the walkers?
Well, the walkers are a family. There were about five families in Hawaii that were considered the big five, who were well-to-do, who'd been there for generations, who had a lot of real estate and financial interests. And Nimitz had gotten to know the Walker family, Sandy and Uno Walker, when he was in Hawaii in the 1920s, building the submarine base as a lieutenant commander. When he came back in 1942, at the end of 1941, to become SINCPAC, Commander-in-Chief Pacific, they reached out to him and said, why don't you come have dinner, and so on and so on. And as time passed, he became closer and closer with the two of them. And their resort on the north coast of Hawaii became kind of a bolt hole for him. He would go there to escape the pressure of the office or just to get away for a night, sometimes for a weekend if he could. And that relationship grew stronger and stronger over time.
Yes, and that exercise was critical to him. He also liked to throw horseshoes, but of course, the dog steals the scene. He has a dog back home called Freckles, who likes to howl along when his wife, Catherine, plays the piano. And your book is enlivened a great deal by including those letters. What we care about is the scenes of home life that he imagines sitting in Honolulu, entertaining all of these people. And so what we have now is a vision of Nimitz the family man, and Nimitz the absolute commander. He was a man for precision, but he also had a playful streak. He liked to listen to music late at night in his quarters. And he early on decides that he's going to get through this with a minimum amount of demand on his staff, on the people. But he's overwhelmed with visitors. Do the visitors start right away, Professor? I know towards the end of the war, there are delegations arriving every day. Are they there in August of 42?
No, in the first 6 months of the war, there are not a lot of visitors. Hawaii was still considered the front line in 1942, and not really till the end of that year. And into 1943 did visitors, congressional delegations, senior officers, groups of British officers and others, newspapermen who would arrive expecting to be greeted and entertained and wined and dined. And this became a pretty serious burden on Nimitz, who liked to focus on his work. You mentioned his walking. He got up every morning and walked at least 3 miles before breakfast and then walked 6 miles after work and before dinner. So he put in probably as many as 10 miles a day. And this was power walking. This was really brisk stuff. So he keeps himself quite active, and he's inundated not only with his professional responsibilities, but with his essentially diplomatic responsibilities of entertaining and charming delegations who come to visit him in Hawaii. And he's very good at both.
But listening all the time to the traffic from Guadalcanal, the Marines, Vandegrift commands the Marines. The overall operation is commanded by a man named Gormley, Admiral Gormley, who Nimitz likes. Gormley is not on Guadalcanal. He's at Noumea, which is a free French post. But Gormley is a man who is, I think Nimitz at one point visits him in frustration, says he's too cautious. What is it that Nimitz thinks about Gormley when he's reading this overwhelming traffic of inadequacy? Gormley doesn't have enough of anything to maintain this battlefront.
It's true. And Nimitz is quite sympathetic with Gormley's dilemma. I mean, he's been asked to conduct this early offensive with inadequate resources, having just arrived in the Pacific, arriving as Nimitz did without a staff. He has to put a staff together. He has to organize a headquarters and then immediately conduct an offensive against a Japanese position in the Solomon Islands. So he's really in a tough spot. And Nimitz sympathizes with all of that. But at the same time, he also recognizes you have got to be more proactive. For one thing, you have to go out there and supervise things for yourself. And Gormley, who had some health problems at the time, he had seriously infected gums, and he's living on an old army transport from World War I, anchored in the bay that has no air conditioning. I mean, he's really struggling. And Nimitz, on the one hand, recognizes the need to support Gormley as much as he can, but at the same time has to accommodate King, who's pushing him from the other side to get going. Let's be more proactive. Let's do more stuff. So here's Nimitz, the man in the middle, if you would, being the fixer that King had always wondered about, trying to resolve this dilemma. And to see him work both sides of this problem is revealing to his character.
There is another relationship that's falling apart at this point, and King and Nimitz observes it. Admiral King does not like Admiral Fletcher. It seems almost based upon, I don't know, it wasn't justified. Fletcher's been a very successful in the battles he's been in. The speculation was that it was because of the loss of the Lexington. What does Nimitz make of this enmity between King and that King has towards Fletcher?
I think that animosity really began when Fletcher was assigned to command the rescue expedition out to Wake Island in December of 1941. Wake Island was under attack by the Japanese. The initial attack had been repelled just 3 days after Pearl Harbor. And so the United States sent a carrier task force to go out there and reinforce the garrison at Wake, but had to slow down to resupply, to refuel. You can't get all the way to Wake Island on one tank of gas. So they had to stop and refuel en route while underway, but it slowed them down enough that the Japanese gained the upper hand, took Wake Island, and King always kind of blamed Fletcher for that because he got the idea that Fletcher worried more about how much fuel he had in his gas tank than he did about getting the job done. It's more than a little bit unfair. King was dissatisfied that the Battle of the Coral Sea wasn't a bigger victory than it was. So King and Fletcher just never quite saw eye to eye, and eventually King managed to shelve him.
There will be a change of command for Guadalcanal when we come back. Nimitz makes a decision. Nimitz at War, Command Leadership from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Craig Simons is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.